prepared to leave, gathering their jackets and trying to shake off the hatred. The black kid, embarrassed at having been debased and ridiculed in cartoon classics like Coal Black and the Seven Dwarfs, and still hiding behind Superman's cape, playfully attacks his Asian homeboy, shouting, "Get Patrick! He's the enemy!" As Patrick raises his hands in self-defense, protesting,
"I'm not the enemy. I'm Chinese."
Bugs Bunny's Jap, monkey, slant eyes, slurs still ringing in his ears. The white kid, unscathed and unfazed from the skirmish, laughs and flips a cigarette into his mouth. Smoke him if you got him. It's crazy how quickly an evening of Little Rascals shorts and Technicolor cartoons, some nearly a century old, can raise the ire of racial antipathy and shame. I couldn't imagine anything being more racist than the entertainment I just witnessed. That's why I knew the rumors about Foy owning a portion of the R-Gang catalog had to be false. What could be more racist than what we just witnessed? I found Hominy in the lobby signing memorabilia, much of it having nothing to do with the Little Rascals. But old movie posters, Uncle Remus collectibles, and Jackie Robinson memorabilia, anything dating to before 1960 would do. Sometimes I forget how funny Hominy is. Back in the day, to avoid the succession of booby traps laid by the white man, black people had to constantly be thinking on their feet. You had to be ready with an impromptu quip or a down-home bromide that would disarm and humble a white provocateur. Maybe if your sense of humor reminded him there was a semblance of humanity underneath that burrhead, you might avoid a beating, get some of that back pay you were owed. Shit, one day of being black in the 40s was equal to 300 years of improv training with the Groundlings in Second City. All it takes is 15 minutes of Saturday night television to see that there aren't many funny black people left, and that overt racism ain't what it used to be. Hominy posed for a group photo with the black-faced women of Nu Iota Gamma. "Do the curtains match the naps?" Hominy said dryly, before delivering a wide smile. Only the real darkie in the group got the joke. And try as she might, she couldn't stop smiling. I sidled up to her. She answered my questions before I could ask them. "I'm pre-med." "And why?" "Because these white bitches got the hookup. That's why. The old girls network exists too, now, and it's no fucking joke. If you can't beat 'em, join 'em. That's what my mama says, because racism's everywhere." "It can't be everywhere," I insisted. The future Dr. Topsy thought a moment, twisting a runaway plate around her finger. "You know, the only place where there's no racism?" She looked around to make sure her sorority sisters weren't within earshot and whispered, "Remember those photos of the black president and his family walking across the White House lawn arm in arm? Within those fucking frames, at that instant, and only in that instant, there's no fucking racism." But there was more than enough racism in the theater lobby to go around. A stoop-shouldered white cat flipped the bill of his baseball cap over his right ear and then slung his arm around Hominy, bust him on the cheek, and exchanged skin. The two did everything but call each other Tambo and Bones.
"I just want to say, all those rappers running off at the mouth about being last of the real niggers don't have jack shit on you. Because you, my man, are more than the last little rascal. You're the last real nigger. And I mean nigger with the hard R."
"Why, thank you, white man.
And do you know why there aren't any more niggers?"
"No, sir, I don't."
"Because white people are the new niggers. We're just too full of ourselves to realize it."
"The new niggers, you say?"
"That's right. Both me and you, niggers to the last. Disenfranchised equals, ready to fight back against the motherfucking system."
"Except that you'll get half the jail time."
Topsy was waiting for us out in the Newark parking lot, still in costume and blackface, but wearing a pair of designer sunglasses and excitedly digging through her book bag. I tried to rush Hominy into the truck before he could see her, but she cut us off.
Mr. Jenkins, I want to show you something.
She took out an oversized 3-ring binder and opened it on the hood of the pickup.
These are copies I made of the ledgers of all the R-Gang and Little Rascals movies shot at Hal Roach Studios and MGM.
Holy shit. Before Hominy could look at them, I snatched the notebook and scanned the columned entries. It was all there. The titles, dates of principal photography, cast and crew, shooting days and total production costs, the profits and losses for all 227 films.
Wait, 227?
I thought there were only 221 movies. Topsy smiled and flipped to the second-to-last page. 6 consecutive entries for films shot in late 1944 were completely blacked out, which meant that 2 hours of prepubescent hijinks that I'd never seen might still exist somewhere. I felt like I was looking at some top-secret FBI report about the Kennedy assassination. I yanked open the binder and held the sheet up to the sun, trying to see through the redaction's blackness and back into time.
"Who do you think did this?"
I asked her. From her book bag, Topsy took out another photocopy. This one listed everyone who'd checked out the ledger since 1963. There were 4 names on it. Mason Reese, Leonard Maltin, Foy Cheshire, and Butterfly Davis, which I presumed was Topsy's real name. Before I lifted my eyes from the paper, Hominy and Butterfly were sitting in the cab. He had one arm around her and was leaning on the horn.
"That nigger got my movies. Let's be out."
From West L.A., the drive to Foy's Hollywood Hills abode took longer than it should have. When my father used to force me to accompany him to his black, brainiac confabs with Foy, no one knew about the north-south shortcuts from the basin into the hills. Back then, Crescent Heights and Rossmore used to be side streets with smooth sailing. Now they're 2-lane, bumper-to-bumper major thoroughfares. Man, I used to swim in Foy's pool while they talked politics and race. Not once did my father ever show any bitterness toward the fact that Foy had paid for that estate with money he earned from The Black Cats and Jammin' Kids, the original storyboards of which still hung on my bedroom wall.
"Dry off, motherfucker," Dad would say. "You're dripping water on the man's Brazilian cherry wood floors."
Most of the ride up, Butterfly and Hominy bonded over photos of her and her sorority sister celebrating the joys of multiculturalism, denigrating the city of Los Angeles ethnicity by ethnicity, neighborhood by neighborhood. In violation of every traffic law and social taboo, she sat in his lap, their seatbelts unbuckled.
"This is me at the Compton cookout. I'm the 3rd ghetto chick from the right."
I stole a glance at the snapshot. The women and their dates, blackened and afro-wigged, toting 40s and basketball, smoking blunts, their mouths filled with gold teeth and chicken drumsticks. It wasn't so much the racist ridicule as the lack of imagination that I found insulting. Where were the zip coons, the hep cats, the mammies, the bucks, the janitors, the dual-threat quarterbacks, the weekend weather forecasters? The front desk receptionist that greets you at every single movie studio and talent agency in the city.
"Mr. Witherspoon will be down in a minute. Can I get you a water?"
That's the problem with this generation. They don't know their history.
"This was the Bingo Sin Gringos night we held for Cinco de Mayo."
As opposed to the Compton cookout, it wasn't hard to spot Butterfly in that one. This time she sat next to an Asian woman. The two of them, like the other sisters, wearing gigantic sombreros, ponchos, bandoleras, and droopy, foot-long Pancho Villa mustaches, while drinking tequila and daubing their cards.
"Be ocho, bingo!"
Butterfly flicked through her photos, the titles of each bash a dress code unto itself. Das Bunker, the pure gene pool pool party, the Shabu Shabu sleepover, the trail of beers, hiking and peyote trip. Sitting just off Mulholland Drive, on the crest overlooking the San Fernando Valley, Foy's house was bigger than I remembered.
a massive Tudor estate with a circular driveway. It looked more like an English finishing school than a home, despite the giant foreclosure sign bolted to the entrance gate. We piled out of the car. The mountain air was brisk and clean. I took in a deep breath and held it while Hominy and Butterfly sauntered up to the gate.
I can smell my movies in there.
Hominy, the place is empty.
They in there. I know it.
What? You gonna dig up the yard like in Unexpected Riches? I asked, invoking Spanky's Our Gang swan song into the mix. Hominy rattled the fence, and then I remembered the code like you remember your best friend's childhood phone number. I punched 1865 into the security box. The gate buzzed, the roller chain tightened, and slowly pulled the gate open. 1865. Black people are so fucking obvious.
Massa, you coming?
No, you two have at it. Across Mulholland was a scenic overlook. Facing north, I timed my run and sprinted between a speeding Maserati and two teenagers in a birthday BMW convertible. A dirt trail peeled down the mountainside and through the chaparral for about a mile or so, eventually leading to a side street and Crystal Water Canyon Park, a small but immaculately kept recreation area featuring a few picnic tables, some shade trees, and a basketball court. Ignoring the sap dripping down its trunk, I sat underneath a thick fir tree. The ball players limbered up for an after-work run or two before the sunset. A lone black man in his mid-30s, light-skinned and shirtless, paced at center court. He was one of those semi-skilled hoopsters who frequented the white courts in ritzy neighborhoods like Brentwood and Laguna, looking for a decent game, an opportunity to dominate, and who knows, maybe even a job prospect. "Any niggas out here for the attention, get the fuck off the court," the brother yelled to the delight of the white boys. The philosophy professor on sabbatical inbounded the ball. A personal injury lawyer hit a corner jumper. Displaying a surprisingly good handle, a fat pharmacist crossovered a pediatrician, but bricked the layup. The day trader airballed a shot that sailed out of bounds and rolled toward the parking lot. Even in L.A., where luxury cars, like shopping carts at the supermarket, are everywhere you look, Foy's 56 300SL was unmistakable. There couldn't have been more than 100 left on the planet. In the front fender, Foy sat in a small lawn chair, dressed in only his boxers, a t-shirt, and sandals, chatting into his phone and typing on a laptop almost as old as his car. He was drying his clothes, his shirts and pants hanging from hangers, hooked onto the car's gull-wing doors, which were in full flight and hovering above like wings on a silver dragon. I had to ask. I got up and walked past the basketball game. Two players vying for a loose ball tumbled by, arguing over possession before they got to their feet. "Who's that off of?" a player in beat-up sneakers asked me, his outstretched arms a silent plea for mercy. I recognized the guy. The mustachioed lead detective in a long-canceled but still in syndication cop show, big in Ukraine. "That's off the dude with the hairy chest." The movie star disagreed, but it was the right call. Foy looked up at me from his chair, but didn't stop talking or typing. Speaking in rapid-fire, unintelligible word salad into the phone, he wasn't making much sense. Something about high-speed rail and the return of the Pullman Porter. The Mercedes coupe's Pirelli white-wall tires were bald. Yellow foam oozed from the cracked and blistered leather seats like pus. Foy was probably homeless, but he refused to sell his watch or a car that at auction, even in its fucked-up condition, was worth several hundred thousand dollars. I had to ask.
"What are you riding?"
Foy dropped the phone to his shoulder.
"A book of essays called Me Talk White One Day."
"Foy, when's the last time you had an original idea?" Absolutely unoffended, Foy thought for a second, then said,
"Probably not since your dad died.
before returning to his phone call. I returned to Foy's old house to find Hominy and Butterfly skinny-dipping in the pool, a little surprised that no nosy neighbors had bothered to call the police. One old black man looks like all the rest, I suppose. Night fell, and the underwater light flicked on automatically and quietly. The soft light blue of a pool lit up at night is my favorite color. Hominy, pretending he couldn't swim, was in the deep end, holding on to Butterfly's ample flotation devices for all he was worth. He hadn't found what he was looking for, his movies, but what he had managed to secure seemed to tide him over. I stripped down and slid into the water. No wonder Foy was broke. The temperature had to have been at least 90 degrees. Floating on my back, I saw the North Star flicker through the steam rising from the water, pointing to a freedom that I didn't even know if I needed. I thought of my father, whose ideas paid for that bank-owned property. I turned over into a dead man's float and tried to position my body in the posture he was in when I found him dead in the street. What were my dad's last words before they shot him? You don't know who my son is. All this work, Dickens, the segregation, Marpesa, the farming, and I still didn't even know who I am. You have to ask yourself two questions. Who am I, and how may I become myself? I was as lost as I ever was, thinking seriously about tearing out the farmland, uprooting the crops, selling off the livestock, and putting in a big-ass wave pool. Because how cool would it be to surf in the backyard? Chapter 23. About 2 weeks after seeking the lost film treasure of Laurel Canyon, the secret was out. The new-ish Republic magazine, which hadn't had a child on its cover since the Lindbergh baby, broke the story. Above the caption, "The New Jim Crow. Has public education clipped the wings of the white child?" was a 12-year-old white boy posed as the pint-sized symbol of reverse racism. The new Jim Crow stood on the steps of Chaff Middle School wearing a heavy gold chain. Unruly tufts of dirty blonde hair peeked out from under his wave cap and noise reduction headphones. He toted an Ebonics textbook in one hand and a basketball in the other. Gold medal braces flashed through a lip-curling snarl, and the triple XL t-shirt he wore read, "Energy equals an MC squared." A long time ago, my father taught me that whenever you see a question on the cover of a news magazine, the answer is always no, because the editorial staff knows that questions with yes answers would, like graphic cigarette warnings and close-ups of puss-oozing genitalia that tend not to deter but encourage smoking and unsafe sex, scare the reader off. So you get yellow journalism, like O.J. Simpson in Race, will the verdict split America? No. Has TV gone too far? No. Is anti-Semitism on the march again? No, because it never halted. Has public education clipped the wings of the white child? No, because a week after that issue hit the newsstands, 5 white kids, their backpacks filled with books, rape whistles, and mace, hopped off a rented school bus and attempted to reintegrate Chaff Middle School, where assistant principal Charisma Molina stood in the doorway, barring entrance to her quasi-segregated institution. Even if Charisma hadn't counted on all the publicity about how if Chaff continued to improve at its current rate, it would become the 4th highest-ranked public school in the country within the next year, she should have known that while 250 poor colored kids getting inferior educations will never be front-page news, the denial of even one white student access to a decent education would create a media shitstorm. What no one could have foreseen, however, was a coalition of fed-up white parents listening to the advice of Foy Cheshire and pulling their children from underperforming public schools and overpriced private ones, and calling for a return to the forced busing many of their parents had so vehemently protested against a generation prior.
too broke and embarrassed to provide an armed escort, the state of California watched idly as the sacrificial lambs of reintegration, Susie Holland, Hannah Nader, Robbie Haley, Keegan Goodrich, and Melanie Vanderweg, exited the bus under the protection of not the National Guard, but the magic of live television and the loud mouth of Foy Cheshire. It had been a couple of weeks since I'd seen him living out of his car, and from what I'd heard, no one showed up for the last dum-dum meeting, even though the noted community organizer, blank blank R, blank 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 O, blank 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 blank, was scheduled to speak, shoulders hunched and arms held up protectively in front of their faces. The Dickens Five, as the quintet would come to be known, braced themselves for the pillory of rocks and bottles as they ran the gauntlet and into history. But unlike Little Rock, Arkansas, on September 3, 1957, the city of Dickens didn't spit in their faces and hurl racial epithets. Rather, it begged them for autographs, asked if they already had dates for the junior prom. Yet when the would-be enrollees reached the top of the stairs, there stood Assistant Principal Charisma doing her best Governor Faubus, refusing to budge, her arm ramrod straight against the door jamb. Hannah, the tallest of the bunch, tried to step around her, but Charisma held firm. No Anglos allowed. Hominy and I were on the other side of the fray. Standing behind Charisma, and like anyone else, apart from the custodial and food services staff at Little Rock Central High School or the University of Mississippi in 1962, on the wrong side of history. Hominy was in school that day to tutor Jim Crow. Charisma had summoned me to read the business letter that accompanied the mailed edition of Foy Cheshire's latest reimagined multicultural text, Of Rice and Yen, an all-Chinese adaptation of Steinbeck's classic set in the days of the railroad coolie. The book was a carbon copy of the original text, sans articles, and with the L's and R's transposed.
Maybe everybody in whole damn world scared, afraid each other.
I'll never understand why after over a half century of Charlie Chan's number one son, the dude in Smashing Pumpkins, dope-ass music producers, skateboarders, and docile Asian wives married to white guys in hardware store commercials, people like Foy Cheshire still think the yen is Chinese currency, and that Asian Americans can't pronounce their fucking L's. But there was something unnerving about the message's hurried scrawl. Dear pawn of the liberal agenda, I know that you won't implement this back-breaking work of swaggering cleverness, but that's your loss. This book will place me firmly in the autodidactic tradition of authors such as Virginia Woolf, Kawabata, Mishima, Mayakovsky, and D.F.W. See you this Monday for the first day of school. Class may be on your campus, but you will be auditing my world. Bring a pen, paper, and the nigger whispering set out. Yours truly, Foy, did you know Gandhi beat his wife, Cheshire? When Charisma asked me why he cited those specific writers, I told her I didn't know, but neglected to mention that the list was composed solely of novelists who had taken their lives. It was hard to say if the statement was some sort of suicidal ideation, but one could hope. There aren't many black firsts left these days. And as much as Foy would be a good candidate for the position of first black writer to off themselves, I had to be prepared. If he was indeed an autodidact, there's no doubt he had the world's shittiest teacher. Foy stepped to the head of the pack to take over the negotiations, magically producing a small stack of DNA results, flapping them, not in Charisma's face, but directly into the lens of the nearest TV camera. I have here in my hand a list of results that show each one of these children has maternal roots tracing their ancestries back thousands of years to Kenya's Great Rift Valley.
Nigga, whose side you on?
From inside the unhallowed halls of the school, I couldn't see who was making the inquiry, but it was a good question. And judging from the silence, one for which Foy didn't have an answer. Not that I knew what side I was on either. All I knew was that the Bible, conscious rappers, and Foy Cheshire weren't on my side. Charisma, however, knew where she stood. And with two hands to his chest, she shoved Foy and the children back down the stairs like so many bowling pins. I looked around at the faces on my side of the threshold. Hominy, the teachers, Sheila Clark, each a little bit frightened, but full of resolve. Shit, maybe I was on the right side of history after all.
I suggest, if you want to go to school in Dickens so badly, you wait for that school across the street to open up.
The prospective white students picked themselves up and turned around to gaze at their forebears, the proud pioneers of the mythical Wheaton Academy. With its pristine facilities, effective teachers, sprawling green campus, there was something undeniably attractive about Wheaton, and the youngsters began gravitating longingly toward their scholastic haven like angels drawn by lute music and decent cafeteria food, until Foy stepped in front of them.
"Don't be fooled by that graven image," he yelled. "That school is the root of all evil. It's a slap in the face of anyone who's ever stood for equality and justice. It's a racist joke that mocks the hard-working people of this and all communities by placing a carrot on a stick and holding it up in front of old horses too tired to run. And besides, it doesn't exist."
"But it looks so real."
"Those are the best dreams, the ones that feel real."
Disappointed, but not defeated, the group settled on the patch of grass near the flagpole. It was a multicultural Mexican standoff. Black-ass Foy and the white kids in the middle, Charisma and the utopian specter of the Wheaton Academy on either side of them. They say that during their weekend skin games, young Tiger Woods' father, in a cheap attempt to rattle his son, would jingle the change in his pocket while his boy was standing over a 6-foot putt for the win. The end result was a duffer who's rarely distracted. I, on the other hand, am easily distracted, permanently sidetracked, because my father liked to play a game he called After the Fact, where in the middle of whatever I was doing, he'd show me a well-known historical photo and ask, "So what happened next?" We'd be at the Bruins game, and during an important timeout, he'd flip the snapshot of Neil Armstrong's footprint in the lunar dust in front of my face. "So what happened next?" I'd shrug my shoulders.
"I don't know. He did those Chrysler commercials on television?"
"Wrong. He became an alcoholic."
"Dad, I think that was Buzz Aldrin."
"In fact, many historians think he was wasted when he first set foot on the moon. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. What the fuck does that even mean?"
In the middle of my first Little League game at bat, Mark Torres, a lanky fireballer whose stuff was hard as a teenage erection and, like that first sexual encounter, preternaturally fast, threw me an 0-2 fastball that neither I nor the umpire saw and only presumed to be high and inside because of the windburn across my forehead. My father came storming out of the dugout, not to impart any batting advice, but to hand me the famous photo of the American and Russian soldiers meeting at the Elbe River, shaking hands and celebrating the de facto end of World War II in the European theater. So what happened next? America and the Soviet Union would go on to fight a Cold War lasting nearly 50 years, and forcing each country to spend trillions of dollars on self-defense in a pyramid scheme Dwight D. Eisenhower would term the military-industrial complex.
Partial credit. Stalin had every Russian soldier in this photograph shot for fraternizing with the enemy.
Depending upon how much of a science fiction geek you are, it's either Star Wars 2 or 5. But whichever one it is, in the middle of the climactic lightsaber duel between Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker, right after the Dark Lord cuts off Luke's arm, my dad snatched the flashlight from an usher's hand, then slammed a black-and-white photo into my chest. So what happened next? In the fuzzy circle of light, a young black woman in an exquisitely ironed white blouse and tablecloth-patterned skirt protectively clutched a 3-ring binder to her still-developing chest and psyche. She wore thick, dark black shades, but stared past both me and the screaming white women tormenting her from behind.
She's one of the Little Rock 9. They sent in federal troops, she went to school, and things ended happily ever after.
What happened next was that the following year the governor, rather than continuing to integrate the school system as required by law, shut down every high school in the city. If niggas wanted to learn, then no one was going to learn. And speaking of learning, notice they don't teach you that part in school.
I never said anything about they being teachers, like my father. I just remember wondering why Luke Skywalker was tumbling headlong into a starlit abyss for no apparent reason. Sometimes I wish Darth Vader had been my father. I'd have been better off. I wouldn't have a right hand, but I definitely wouldn't have the burden of being black and constantly having to decide when and if I give a shit about it. Plus, I'm left-handed. So, there everybody was, stubborn as grass stains, waiting for someone to intervene. The government, God, color-safe bleach, the Force, whoever. Exasperated, Charisma looked over at me. When does this shit ever end? It doesn't, I muttered, and stepped into the breezy perfection that is the springtime California morning. Forehead prepped his troops for a boisterous chorus of We Shall Overcome. They were joined together, arm in arm, swaying and humming slowly to the beat. Most folks think We Shall Overcome is still in the public domain, that through the generosity of the black struggle, its empowering refrains are free to be sung by anyone, any time one feels the stings of injustice and betrayal, which is how it should be. But if you stood outside the U.S. Copyright Office and protested the people profiting from a stolen song by singing We Shall Overcome, you'd owe the estate of Pete Seeger a nickel for every rendition. And even though Foy, singing for all he was worth, had seen fit to change the poignant someday lyric to a screaming right now, I dropped 10 cents on the pavement as a precaution. Foy lifted his hands high overhead, his sweater popping over his pot belly and exposing a gun handle sticking out of his Italian leather belt line. That explained the lyric change, his impatience, the letter, and the desperate look in his eyes. And why didn't I recognize it sooner? The absence of angularity in his normally pristine box-cut toupee. Charisma, call the police. No one other than college hippies, Negro Jubilee singers, Cubs fans, and other assorted idealists knows verses 2 through 6 of We Shall Overcome. And when his flock started stumbling over the next verse, Foy pulled his weapon and waved it like a .45 caliber cue card, exhorting his choir through the rough patches, even though their backs were turned to him, and flying past me and Hominy toward the school's entrance, which remained closed to them because Charisma had shut the doors behind her. Dickens doesn't scatter very easily. Neither does a local media used to gangland slayings and a seemingly endless supply of psycho killers. So when Foy clacked 2 shots at the back end of his Mercedes, crookedly parked on Rosecrans, the crowd only parted wide enough to create a fire lane through which the white kids could reach the relative safety of their school bus, where they lowered themselves into their seats. Desegregation is never easy in any direction, and after Foy fired 2 more rounds into their civil rights movement, progress would be even slower, because the Freedom Bus had a couple of flat tires. Foy pumped another shot into the Mercedes-Benz logo. This time the trunk popped open in that slow, majestic way that only Mercedes trunks do, and he grabbed an old bucket of whitewash out of the back. But before I or anyone else could reach him, he spun around, warding us off with his strap and his off-key singing. He'd made another lyric change, this time personalizing the tune by changing the refrain to, "I shall overcome." What's that the judges always say on those televised singing competitions? You really made the song your own. The pop of a can of paint opening is always a most satisfying sound. And justifiably pleased with himself and his car keys, Foy, still singing at the top of his lungs, rose to his feet with his back to the street
aimed his pistol directly at my chest.
"I seen it a million times," my father used to say. "Professional niggas that just snap because the charade is over."
The blackness that had consumed them suddenly evaporates like window grit washed away in the rain. All that's left is the transparency of the human condition, and everybody sees right through you. The lie on the resume has finally been discovered. The reason it takes them so long to write their reports has been unearthed, and the tardiness isn't due to a painstaking attention to detail, but to dyslexia. The suspicions confirmed that the ever-present bottle of mouthwash on the colored man's desk in the corner, near the restroom, isn't filled with a liquid designed to kill bad breath and provide 24-hour protection against germs that cause gum disease and gingivitis, but peppermint schnapps. A liquid designed to kill bad dreams and provide a false sense of security that your Listerine smile is killing them softly.
"Seen it a million times," he'd say. "At least niggas on the East Coast have the Vineyard and Sag Harbor. What we got? Las Vegas and fucking El Pollo Loco. Personally, I love El Pollo. And not that I was totally convinced that Foy was a danger to me or anyone else, but if I got out of this alive, the first thing I'd do was visit the one over on Vermont and 58th Street, order me a 3-piece combo, dark, with flame-grilled corn and mashed potatoes, and one of those delicious red fruit punches that tastes like my 8-year-old birthday party." The sirens were half a town away. Even when the county was flush with property tax revenue on overvalued homes, Dickens never received its fair share of the civil services. And now, with the cutbacks and graft, the response time is measured in eons. The same switchboard operators who took the calls from the Holocaust, Rwanda, Wounded Knee, and Pompeii, still at their posts. Foy turned the gun away from me and raised it to his ear. Then, with his free hand, dumped the pail of unstirred and semi-hardened stain over his head. In clumpy folds, the paint oozed over the left half of his face, and down the length of that side of his body, until one eye, one nostril, one shirt sleeve, one pant leg, and one Patek Philippe watch were washed completely white. Foy was no tree of knowledge. At most, he was a bush of opinion. But in any case, it was obvious that, publicity stunt or not, he was dying on the inside. I looked down at his roots. One brown shoe splattered with paint from the milky waterfall that sluiced through his goatee and fell from his chin. This time there was no doubt that he'd lost it, because if there's one thing a successful black man like Foy loves more than God, country, and his ham-hock-limbed mama, it's his shoes. I stepped to him, my arms raised and my hands open. Foy pressed the gun barrel even deeper into his misshapen afro, holding himself hostage. Suicide by cop or cop out, I didn't much care, but I was glad he'd finally stopped singing. "Foy," I said, sounding surprisingly like my father, "you have to ask yourself two questions. Who am I, and how may I become myself?" I waited for the expected, "I do and do for you niggers, and this is the thanks I get," diatribe about how no one was buying his books. How even though he was the producer, director, editor, caterer, and star of a television talk show that's been syndicated on 2 continents and brought a droll, homogenized, and romanticized version of black intellectual thought into 10s of homes in over 6 countries, nothing has changed about how the world sees us, much less how we see ourselves. How he was directly responsible for getting a black man elected president and nothing changed. How last week, a nigger won $75,000 on Teen Jeopardy and nothing changed. How, in fact, things have gotten worse. And how you can tell things are getting worse. Because poverty has disappeared from the vernacular and our consciousness. Because there's white boys working at the car wash. Because the women in porn are better looking than ever.
and it's handsome gay men who are straight for pay. Because famous actors do commercials extolling the virtues of the phone companies and the United States Army. You know how you can tell shit is fucked up? Because someone thinks it's still 1950 and sees fit to reintroduce segregation to the American ethos. That someone wouldn't be you, would it, sellout? Putting up signs, erecting fake schools like the ghetto was some sort of phony Paris complete with railway stations, Arc de Triomphes, and Eiffel Towers built during World War I to fool the German bombers. Like the Germans, who in turn, in the next war, built fake stores, theaters, and parks in Theresienstadt to dupe the Red Cross into believing that no atrocities were taking place, when the entire war was a series of fucking atrocities. One bullet, one illegal detention, one sterilization, one atom bomb at a time. You can't fool me. I'm not the Luftwaffe or the Red Cross. I didn't grow up in this hellhole. Like father, like son. When it's your blood running through your fingers, the amount can only be described as copious. But writhing in the gutter, clutching at my innards, I began to feel something akin to closure. I never heard the shot, but for the first time in my life I had something in common with my father. We'd both been shot in the gut by gutless motherfuckers. And there was a certain satisfaction in that. I felt as if I'd finally paid my debt to him and his fucked-up notions of blackness in childhood. Daddy never believed in closure. He said it was a false psychological concept, something invented by therapists to assuage white Western guilt. In all his years of study and practice, he'd never heard a patient of color talk of needing closure. They needed revenge. They needed distance. Forgiveness and a good lawyer, maybe, but never closure. He said people mistake suicide, murder, lap band surgery, interracial marriage, and over-tipping for closure. When in reality, what they've achieved is erasure. The problem with closure is that once you have a taste of it, you want it in every little aspect of your life. Especially when you're bleeding to death and your slave, who is in full rebellion, is screaming, "Give me back my little rascal movies, motherfucker!" and pummeling your assailant with such knobby-knuckled fury that it takes half the L.A. County Sheriff's Department to pull him off, while you attempt to staunch the bleeding with a waterlogged copy of Vibe magazine someone has left in the gutter. You don't have time to let anything slide. Kanye West has announced, "I am rap." Jay-Z thinks he's Picasso, and life is fucking fleeting. The ambulance will be here soon. Things had finally settled down. Hominy, who couldn't stop crying, had taken off his t-shirt, rolled it into a pillow, and cradled my head in his lap. A sheriff's deputy squatted over me, poking gently at my wound with the butt end of her flashlight. "That was a fucking brave thing you did, nigger whisperer. Can I get you anything in the meantime?" "Closure." "I don't think you'll need stitches. It doesn't look like a belly shot. It's more like you've been hit in the love handle. It's superficial, really." Anyone who's ever described a bullet wound as being superficial has never been shot. But I wasn't about to let a little lack of empathy get in the way of total closure. "It's illegal to yell fire in a crowded theater, right?" "It is." "Well, I've whispered racism in a post-racial world." I told her about my efforts to restore Dickens, and how I thought building the school would give the town a sense of identity. She patted me sympathetically on the shoulder and raised her supervisor on the radio, and while we waited for the ambulance, the three of us haggled about the severity of the crime. The county, reluctant to cite me with anything more than vandalism of state property, and me trying to convince them that even if crime had gone down in the neighborhood since the Wheaton Academy went up, what I did was still a violation of the First Amendment, the Civil Rights Code, and unless there's been an armistice in the War on Poverty, at least four articles of the Geneva Convention. The paramedics arrived. Once I'd been stabilized with gauze and a few kind words, the EMTs went through the standard assessment protocol. Next of kin, as I lay, not exactly dying but close enough, I thought about Marpesa, who, if the position of the sun high in the gorgeous blue sky was any indication, was at the far end of this very same street, taking her lunch break, her bus parked facing the ocean. Her bare feet on the dashboard, nose buried in Camus, listening to the talking heads, this must be the place. I have a girlfriend, but she's married.
What about this guy?
She asked, pointing a ballpoint pen at a shirtless hominy, standing just off to the side, giving his statement to a sheriff's deputy who was writing in a notepad and shaking her head incredulously.
Is he family?
Family!
Hominy, overhearing the paramedic and somewhat insulted, wiped down his wrinkly underarms with his T-shirt and came over to see how I was doing.
Why, I is something closer than family.
He says he's his slave,
the deputy chimed in, reading from her notes.
Been working for him, according to this crazy fucker, the last 400 years.
The EMT nodded, running her powdered, rubber-gloved hands down the length of Hominy's saggy, skinned back.
How did you get these welts?
I was whooped. How else a no-account, shiftless nigger like me gonna get whoop marks on his back?
Having handcuffed me to the stretcher board, the sheriff's deputies knew they finally had something to charge me with. Though we still couldn't agree on the crime as they carried me through the crowd into the ambulance.
Human trafficking?
Nah, he's never been bought or sold. What about involuntary servitude?
Maybe, but it's not like you're forcing him to work.
It's not like he's working.
Did you really whip him?
Not directly. I pay some people. It's a long story. One of the EMTs had to tie her shoes. She set me down on a wooden bus stop bench while she adjusted her laces. From the seat back, a photo of a familiar face comforted me with a soothing smile and a red power tie.
You got a good lawyer? The deputy asked.
Just call this nigger right here. I knocked on the advertisement. It said, Hampton Fisk, attorney at law. Remember, there are 4 steps to acquittal. 1, don't say shit. 2, don't run. 3, don't resist arrest. 4, don't say shit. 1-800-FREEDOM. Say habla español. He showed up late to the grand jury indictment, but Hampton's services were worth every dime. I told him I couldn't afford to do jail time. I had crops coming in, and one of the mares was scheduled to fold in about 2 days. With this knowledge in tow, he strolled into the hearing, brushing leaves off his suit jacket and flicking twigs from his perm, carrying a bowl of fruit and talking about, "As a farmer, my client is an indispensable member of a minority community well-documented for being malnourished and underfed. He's never left the state of California. Owns a 20-year-old pickup truck that runs on fucking ethanol, which is next to impossible to find in this city. And thus, he's not a flight risk." The California Attorney General, flown in from Sacramento just to prosecute my case, leapt to her Prada-shod feet.
"Objection. This defendant, evil genius that he is, has through his aberrant actions managed to racially discriminate against every race all at the same time, to say nothing of his unabashed slaveholding. The state of California feels that it has more than enough evidence to prove that the defendant is an abject violation of the Civil Rights Acts of 1866, 1871, 1957, 1964, and 1968. The Equal Rights Act of 1963, the 13th and 14th Amendments, and at least 6 of the goddamn 10 Commandments. If it were within my power, I'd charge him with crimes against humanity.
This
is an example of my client's humanity, Hampton countered calmly, gently setting the fruit bowl on the judge's bench, then backing away with a deep bow. Freshly picked from my client's farm, Your Honor. Judge Nguyen rubbed his tired eyes. He selected a nectarine from the offering and rolled it in his fingers as he spoke. The irony is not lost on me that we sit here in this courtroom, a female state's attorney general of black and Asian lineage, a black defendant, a black defense counselor, a Latina bailiff, and me, a Vietnamese-American district judge, setting the parameters for what is essentially a judicial argument about the applicability, the efficacy, and the very existence of white supremacy as expressed through our system of law. And while no one in this room would deny the basic premise of civil rights, we'd argue forever and a day about what constitutes equal treatment under the law, as defined by the very articles of the Constitution this defendant is accused of violating. In attempting to restore his community through reintroducing precepts, namely segregation and slavery, that, given his cultural history, have come to define his community despite the supposed unconstitutionality and non-existence of these concepts, he's pointed out a fundamental flaw in how we as Americans claim we see equality. I don't care if you're black, white, brown, yellow, red, green, or purple. We've all said it, posited as proof of our non-prejudicial ways. But if you painted any one of us purple or green, we'd be mad as hell. And that's what he's doing. He's painting everybody over, painting this community purple and green, and seeing who still believes in equality. I don't know if what he's done is legal or not. But the one civil right I can guarantee this defendant is the right to due process, the right to a speedy trial. We convene tomorrow morning at 9:00, but buckle up, people. No matter the verdict, innocent or guilty, this is going to the Supreme Court. So I hope you ain't got nothing scheduled for the next 5 years. Bail is set. Judge Nguyen took a big bite out of the nectarine, then kissed his crucifix. Bail is set at a cantaloupe and 2 kumquats. Unmitigated Blackness. Chapter 24. I expected the air conditioning in the Supreme Court to be for shit, like it is in all the good courtroom movies. 12 Angry Men and To Kill a Mockingbird. Movie trials always take place in humid locales in the heat of summer because the psych books say crime goes up with the temperature. Tempers run short. Perspiring witnesses and trial attorneys start yelling at each other. The jurors fan themselves, then open 4-paned windows looking for escape and a breath of fresh air. Washington, D.C. is fairly muggy this time of year, but it's mild, damn near frigid, inside the courthouse. Yet I have to open a window anyway to let out all the smoke and 5 years of judicial system frustration. "You can't handle the weed!" I shout at Fred Mann, courtroom artist extraordinaire and film buff. It's the dinner break to what has amounted to the longest Supreme Court case in history. We're still in a nameless antechamber, passing time and a joint back and forth, butchering the climax of A Few Good Men, which isn't a great movie, but Jack Nicholson's disdain for the actors and the script and the way he delivers that last monologue carry the film. "Did you order the code red?" "I might have. I'm so fucking high right now." "Did you order the code red?" "You're goddamn right I did, and I'd do it again because this pot is fucking unbelievable." Fred's breaking character. "What's it called?" "It," being the joint he's holding in his hand. "It doesn't have a name yet, but code red sounds pretty good."
Fred has sketched all the important cases. Same-sex marriage, the end of the Voting Rights Act, and the demise of affirmative action in higher education and, by extension, everywhere else. He says that in his 30 years of courtroom artistry, this is the first time he's ever seen the court adjourn for dinner. First time he's ever seen the justices raise their voices and stare each other down. He shows me an artist's rendering of today's session. In it, a conservative Catholic justice flips off a liberal Catholic justice from the Bronx with a surreptitious cheek scratch. "What does coño mean?"
"What?"
That's what she whispered under her breath, followed by, "Chupa mi verga, cabrón." My colored pencil caricature looks terrible. I'm in the lower left-hand corner of the drawing. I can't speak to the court, allowing for unregulated corporate spending on political campaigns or the burning of the American flag, but the best decision it's ever made was to prohibit the use of cameras in the courtroom, because apparently I'm one ugly motherfucker. My bulbous nose and gigantic ears protrude from my bald Mount Fuji-shaped head like fleshy anemometers. I'm flashing a yellow-toothed smile and staring at the youngish Jewish justice like I can see through her robe. Fred says the reason they don't permit cameras has nothing to do with maintaining decorum and dignity. It's to protect the country from seeing what's underneath Plymouth Rock. Because the Supreme Court is where the country takes out its dick and tits and decides who's going to get fucked and who's getting a taste of mother's milk. It's constitutional pornography in there. And what did Justice Potter once say about obscenity? I know it when I see it. Fred, do you think you could at least shave down my incisors? I look like fucking Blackula. Blackula, underrated movie. Fred unclips the press laminate from his lanyard and uses the metal fastener as a makeshift roach clip to finish the rest of the weed in one mighty toke. His eyes and nasal passages close tight. I ask him, can I borrow a pencil? He nods yes, and I take the opportunity to remove all the brown-colored implements from his fancy pencil case. Fuck if I'm going down in history as the homeliest litigant in Supreme Court history. During social studies, otherwise known in Dad's curriculum as the ways and means of the indefatigable white people, my father used to warn me about listening to rap or the blues with Caucasian strangers. And as I got older, I'd be admonished not to play Monopoly, drink more than two beers, or smoke weed with them either. For such activities can breed a false sense of familiarity. And nothing, from the hungry jungle cat to the African ferry boat, is more dangerous than a white person on what they think is familiar ground. And as Fred returns from exhaling a cloud of smoke out into the D.C. night, he has that "ain't I a soul, brother" glint in his eyes. "Let me tell you something, my man. I've seen them all come through here. Racial profiling, interracial marriage, hate speech, and race-based set-asides. And you know what the difference is between my people and yours? As much as we both want seats at the table, once you get inside, you motherfuckers never have an escape plan. Us, we're prepared to leave at a moment's notice. I never enter a restaurant, bowling alley, or an orgy without asking myself, if they choose this moment to come get me, how in the fuck am I getting out of here? Cost us a generation, but we learned our fucking lesson. They told you people, school's out, ain't no more lessons to be learned, and you dumb fucks believe them. Think about it. If the damn stormtroopers were to knock on the door right now, what would you do? What's your exit strategy?" There's a knock on the door. It's a court officer gulping down the last of a prefabricated spicy tuna roll. She's wondering why I have one leg dangling out of the window. Fred simply shakes his head. I look down. Even if I were to survive the three-story fall, I'd be trapped in a tacky marble courtyard, walled in by 30 feet of overblown colonial architecture, surrounded by lion heads, bamboo stalks, red orchids, and a silty fountain. On our way out, Fred points to a small, hobbit-sized side door behind a potted plant that presumably leads to the Promised Land. I re-enter the chambers to find an insanely pale white boy in my seat. It's like he's waited until the fourth quarter of the ball game to move down from the upper deck, sneak